The following lecture was presented by Dr. Gillis Harp, Professor of History at Grove City College, at Trinity School for Ministry's Dean's Hour in the fall of 2018. His topic is An Historical Approach to Anglican Identity, or Why Are We Afraid of the Reformation? This lecture provides a helpful and winsome diagnosis of the theological confusion within current expressions of Anglicanism and focuses us on what our tradition is really all about. Please tune in.
So my title this morning is an historical approach to Anglican identity, or why are we afraid of the Reformation? How's that for provocative? And so I want to talk a little bit about how the academic perspective on the Reformation has changed in the last few decades, how a lot of lay people, and I'm sorry to say clergy, haven't really kept up with that, and what light that could shed on the question of Anglican identity. My involvement with an ACN church plant, Ethan can tell you about, has made me especially aware of the need to explain clearly to non-Anglicans, both, of course, what we share with other Christians, but also what distinguishes the Anglican tradition. A sizable portion of our congregation is composed of students, and most of whom, are not from Anglican or Episcopal backgrounds. So there's a reason why I've been thinking about these issues, a sort of a practical question. My talk today seeks to grapple with the question of Anglican identity. First, a very brief critical assessment of one recent popular approach. I hope to take not too long on that because some of that's going to be familiar to you, and I don't want to sound like a one-note person. And then, more substantially, by exploring what a more historically informed portrait might look like. In light of this year's 500th anniversary of the Reformation, I'll stress how a recovery of the Church of England's neglected Protestant faith can provide a deeper and more historically accurate representation of what Anglicanism has meant at its best. Unfortunately, many Anglican clergy and laity haven't kept up with the scholarship on the English Reformation, and I'm afraid it shows. I'll argue that the accepted view in some circles is long overdue for correction. All right, let me start out with this one popular approach. As I said, I don't want to spend too much time in this. Some of you have already read my screeds on the topic and you're bored with it, which I understand. A few years ago, I wrote two short essays on the subject of Anglican identity, offering some gentle criticism of what's sometimes called the three streams model. The response to these essays surprised me. It seemed that I had hit a nerve. Maybe not, but you know, if you're an academic and you publish articles and books, you basically never hear from anybody about any of it. But you write something on a blog and you get, you know, 500 emails the next morning. So I can see what's going on there. Champions of this three streams approach understand Anglicanism as a kind of coming together of three streams within Christianity. You've heard it before. Usually they make reference to the Catholic, the Evangelical, or sometimes they call it the Protestant, and the Pentecostal or maybe charismatic stream or tradition, looking at these as tributaries being channeled into a single river or stream. If you look at this historically, which is, as a historian I like to do, the origins of the model are actually a little obscure. Church of South India Bishop and missiologist Leslie Newbegin wrote a short book, The Household of God, back in 1953, that referred to these three elements and how their distinctive characteristics complemented each other. More than 30 years later, Gordon Conwell church historian Richard Lovelace wrote a breezy but very influential article for Charisma magazine that argued that, quote, there are many signs that history is moving in the direction of organic unity between Catholic, Protestant, and Pentecostal streams. Now, certainly several of the objectives of the three streams advocates, I think, are commendable. When the moral teaching of the Christian church is being systematically dismantled in our day, when, in fact, the very notion of a revealed supernatural faith is being rejected, it's clearly important for those committed to creedal orthodoxy to seek common ground and to cooperate. An irenic spirit is behind much of this three streams approach, and I want to applaud that. When grappling with ecumenical matters, such an approach is, I think, helpful and praiseworthy. But you're waiting for the shoe to drop. But the popularity of the three streams model to Anglican identity may be a product of other features of contemporary Christianity that are not necessarily virtues. For one, sometimes the three streams hermeneutic can treat our current theological model as a virtue. It's not a problem, it's an opportunity. A virtue rather than, say, honestly recognizing its sometimes superficiality and perhaps even incoherence. After all, if you look at Newbegin's book, it takes an occasionally helpful but oversimplified descriptive model of the Western Church during the middle part of the 20th century and turns it into, or can turn it into, a prescriptive theological ideal, saying this is a goal. And it reads back, I think, anachronistically into the past. Newbegin's original description may be a helpful way to conceptualize some of the different traditions within Christianity and to further ecumenical discussion, understanding, cooperation, that's all good. But using it to create a kind of easy doctrinal synthesis, that's an entirely different matter. Nor are the differences between the three streams all simple differences of emphasis. Some actually constitute opposed positions based upon very different readings of the Bible. All right, second, that's point one. Point two. Second, and perhaps most germane to my main subject this morning, and I said I don't want to spend too much time on this. This is kind of preliminary. The three streams approach tends to either denigrate or neglect both the Anglican reformers and the Anglican formularies. Following the dated and highly partisan work of Benedictine Dom Gregory Dix, it characterizes the chief author of the Book of Common Prayer and the Articles as, yes, he was a gifted liturgist, but not a deep or sophisticated theologian. His gift to Anglicanism was a sort of studied ambiguity that his successors were then free to develop in their distinctive directions. Some three streams teaching either misunderstands the Protestant Reformation, summarizes it cursorily, or simply leaps over it. Although Robert Weber occasionally noted the superiority of the Reformers' worship over that of, say, modern American evangelicals, he focused far greater attention in his many books on the first five centuries of church history. When handling subjects where the Reformers disagreed with, say, patristic positions, Weber rarely sided with the Reformers. Significantly, he invariably drew upon the 1979 American Prayer Book rather than the historic 1662 or 28 BCP. So, part of the appeal of the three streams approach is that it confirms, I would say, a bad tendency to not take the Reformation seriously. Anglicans today, and this is especially true of North American Anglicans, have long either ignored or downplayed the significance of the English Reformation. For the bulk of my talk, set aside now the three streams question, for the bulk of my talk, I'd like now to explore this distorted and ahistorical view of the English Reformation and to suggest something of a corrective. Okay, so my heading here is a distorted portrait of the English Reformation. Historian and Cranmer biography Dermaid McCulloch ably described this misleading approach in an article published several years ago called The Myth of the English Reformation. If you haven't read it, you should. There are actually two different versions of it, one a longer kind of scholarly one and then a more popular one. It was published in History Today. Let me just say at the outset here, I'm quoting McCulloch as a scholar and as a historian, not as a theologian. His theological views are not orthodox, to say the least. He puts the point succinctly, quote, "The myth of the English Reformation is that it did not happen, or that it happened by accident rather than by design, or that it was half-hearted and sought a kind of via media between Catholicism and Protestantism. And the point at issue is the identity of the Church of England," end quote. Those who concocted the myth did so for theological reasons. They sought to emphasize, and again, McCulloch's words, quote, "the structural Catholic continuity of the Church over the break of the Reformation." So, continuity over discontinuity. Although in some respects this may have been a laudable goal, some played fast and loose with the historical record to arrive at the portrait they sought. Who painted the portrait? Well, the myth was constructed by partisans. First, in the 17th century, I don't want to spend a lot of time on them, But then in the latter half of the 19th century, and they were far more radical. I think it's difficult for Anglicans today, and this is especially true in North America, where we have a much more monochrome situation in terms of churchmanship. It's difficult for Anglicans today to recognize how different Anglicanism looked prior to the late 19th century. Indeed, McCulloch contends that, quote, the 19th century growth of Anglo-Catholicism amounted to nothing less than an ideological revolution in the Church of England, which involved radically reinterpreting its history. In other words, they weren't just talking about contemporary doctrine, they were going back and reinterpreting the history. McCulloch notes that the Anglo-Catholic churchmen were in good position to do this. They started life as a university-based movement, and they have always kept their university base. Anglo-Catholic writers asked the questions which they wanted to ask of their research and drew the conclusions they wanted to draw. McCulloch aptly describes how this older historiography was traditionally embarrassed by the Protestant convictions of the English reformers. You see, the problem is you have to get around people like Cranmer, Ridley, and Latimer, and that's hard to do. Although they acknowledge Cranmer as the chief architect of the Book of Common Prayer, they curiously stress his first experimental edition of 1549 and dismiss the 1552 version that best expressed his mature position. And that, of course, was the basis of all subsequent revisions up to 1662. Those churchmen who inconveniently don't fit the model are either ignored or defined as somehow un-Anglican. This is what we did with the Puritans. They weren't really Anglicans. They were Anglicans, and then there were these Puritan people. Thus, someone like Archbishop Grindal, the Archbishop of Canterbury, after all, was in one account described as, quote, that false son of the church, a perfidious prelate. I have known some perfidious prelates, but he wasn't one of them. Furthermore, the late 16th and early 17th century conforming Puritans, these are the conforming Puritans, despite their theological brilliance, have, in McCulloch's words, quote, been shunted off into a siding seen as not quite fully part of the Church of England, end quote. So these non-separatist Puritan churchmen would definitely have been confused to have been treated as somehow outside of the Church of England. At the same time, Elizabeth's bishops, Queen Elizabeth I, most of them devoted Protestants who, after all, had fled England when Queen Mary came to the throne, would have been very puzzled to have heard that the Church of England described, would have been puzzled to see it described as some sort of compromise halfway house between Rome and Geneva. Here again, the myth of the Via Media. All right, well, that's just by way of introduction. I want to bring this a little closer to home and a little excursus right now. We'll come back to the 16th and 17th centuries in a minute. But for a moment here, I want to talk about North America. Let me interject here an American example of McCulloch's case to kind of supplement McCulloch's case. So he talks about the myth of the English Reformation. Well, the myth of the English Reformation has also, I would argue, contributed a distorted reading of Episcopal church history. Of course, the first permanent English colony in Virginia was founded after the Elizabethan settlement, but the old conventional view of Anglican origins, I would argue, has also borne bad fruit on this side of the Atlantic. Those clergy and movements most committed to the core principles of the Reformation, that is, the evangelicals, have either been treated as somehow un-Anglican or just outright ignored altogether. For example, conventional denominational histories often make perfunctory mention of Anglican evangelist and leader of the Great Awakening, George Whitefield. But they spend far more time on, say, Samuel Seabury. This, despite the fact that Whitefield has been called by colonial historians the first bona fide American celebrity whose last sermon in Boston attracted 23,000 listeners. Now remember, this is at a time when the population of Boston was maybe 20, maybe 25,000. This would be like a whole city coming out to hear someone. Don't get me wrong, I like Samuel Seabury. He didn't attract those kind of crowds. Indeed, by the close of his career, Whitefield may have addressed as many as 10 million listeners in total. That's an incredible figure. If you figure out that on the eve of the American Revolution, the population of the colonies is about 3 million. So, a lot of people are going back to hear Whitfield. Incredibly, James Madison, this is Bishop James Madison, not the other guy, who oversaw the decline of the Diocese of Virginia during his decidedly uninspired tenure between 1790 and 1812, usually gets more attention in standard denominational histories. They talk at length about James Madison, who messed up pretty major, but they don't talk about Whitfield, or Whitfield gets a sentence. Nor is the imbalance only evident in older accounts. You might say, well, Harp, you're just talking about all of these old accounts, written in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Sorry to say, not the case. Robert Pritchard's A History of the Episcopal Church, 1999 edition, contains a few pages on Wesley, a few on Whitfield in the 18th century. But for the entire 19th century, the evangelicals, in a 300-page book, more than 300 pages, get 3 pages. This, despite the fact evangelicals were a force to reckon with in the Protestant Episcopal Church for most of the 19th century. One contemporary observer at the time estimated that in 1856, 50% of Protestant Episcopal Church bishops were evangelicals, and he estimated supposedly 2/3 of its parochial clergy were evangelical. I think that estimate's high, but nonetheless, it's interesting that people were saying that. By the Civil War, the evangelical party in the Episcopal Church was sizable and influential. Evangelical churchmen and women contributed much of to the spiritual and institutional life of the denomination that it enjoyed in the antebellum era. They were a force to reckon with in dioceses like Virginia, Massachusetts, and elsewhere. They founded 3 seminaries, one in Alexandria, one in Gambier, Ohio, and one in Philadelphia. They edited newspapers such as the Episcopal Record and the Episcopalian, back in the days when that was worth reading, and ran organizations such as the Evangelical Education Society to support evangelical ministerial candidates, and the Evangelical Knowledge Society to publish evangelical tracts, books, Sunday school materials, to mention only a couple. I remember back in the 1980s, I was visiting my in-laws in Northern Virginia, and I was walking through Virginia Theological Seminary Library, and they were throwing out all these old books, and I can't tell you how many of them had the imprint of the Evangelical Knowledge Society on them. It was a huge number, and sadly, VTS wasn't interested in what they taught anymore. Incidentally, it's remarkable how quickly this significant church party declined during the late 19th century. I think you have in front of you an article I wrote a few years back in Anglican Episcopal History that goes into detail about this. And if you're not that interested in what I'm saying, you can read it right now. That's what my students do. So I'll feel right at home. No. Please read that later, okay? Look at that later. Okay. I just want to say a couple things about that, and I'll move back to my main topic. It's remarkable how quickly this significant church party declined in the late 19th century. Only 7 years after some evangelicals left the Episcopal Church for the Reformed Episcopal Church in 1873, a visitor to Stephen H. Ting's once important preaching station, that's St. George's in Manhattan, noted only 33 persons in attendance and commented, quote, "Must it be said of St. George's, Ichabod?" 8 years later, Edward Cheney remarked, quote, "Today the old evangelical party is like the race of mound builders of the Western Plains. It is hopelessly extinct," end quote. Now, what we need to remember, and I'm often telling my students this, is the winners write the history. Accordingly, older official histories of the Episcopal Church so neglected evangelicals that their disappearance didn't really require an explanation. I mean, we didn't talk about them to begin with, so it doesn't matter if they left or somehow suddenly declined. Indeed, it was something of a non-event. James T. Addison's standard denominational history simply defined them out of the church. Quote, "Not being true Anglicans in spirit," he noted with condescension, "Bishop Cummins and his followers could not endure the tension that characterizes a comprehensive church," end quote. One of the few older historians who did give evangelical Episcopalians attention, this is E.C. Chorley. And if you've never looked at Chorley's book published back in the 1930s, it's really worth a look. It's called Men and Movements in the Episcopal Church, and it has chapters and chapters on evangelicals. It's very interesting. Chorley saw the Reformed Episcopal split as removing the hardline evangelicals, while those who remained had the good sense to, you guessed it, become liberals. Along the lines of McCulloch's myth of the English Reformation, we have the American version of this. We have the American version of a kind of myth of the evangelical party in the American church. My colleague Alan Gelzo has described as what he calls a myth of synthesis within the Episcopal Church, served by paying little attention to evangelicals or simply fitting them into the progressive history of liberal triumph. You know, it's kind of the Whiggish history. I don't know if you've ever read Herbert Butterfield's little book, Whig History, where, you know, he talks about that, how it's all, going toward this sort of progressive consummation. Conservative evangelicals were defined as un-Anglican, while those who embraced the broad church were celebrated. The resulting sanitized portrait highlighted an inevitable movement toward a comprehensive, but of course, liberal church. So my point here is simply, this is just, as I said, sort of an excursus about the North American situation. My point here is that what McCulloch has identified in the case of this myth of the English Reformation, it has bad fruit in terms of our situation in North America. So, but back to the Church of England and its formative decades. So if the older partisan reading of the English Reformation is mostly mythical, what would a more accurate portrait look like? How can careful historical study contribute to a less fanciful picture of Anglican origins? Happily, Anglicans today can benefit enormously from the substantial body of scholarship on the English Reformation that has appeared in the last few decades. Professional historians have really redrawn the map of the English Reformation going back to, you could say it started as far back as the 1980s. In some cases, even a little earlier. While there continues to be considerable disagreement, don't get me wrong, there's definitely disagreement and debate among scholars in the scholarly literature about some aspects of the Reformation in England, there is a consensus of sorts regarding many matters. Most academic historians now recognize that the Protestant-Catholic bridge church model of the Anglican settlement is not particularly accurate historically. Cranmer scholar Ashley Null sometimes quotes a fellow historian Dewey Wallace's characterization of the Church of England between 1547 and the 1620s. He summarizes the consensus this way nicely. He says, the C of E was, quote, a Reformed church with hankerings after Lutheranism. As the University of Warwick's Peter Marshall has written, quote, most recent scholarship has stressed both the clearly Protestant texture of the Elizabethan settlement and the explicitly Reformed character of the theology and identity of the resulting church, end quote. In other words, for much of the 16th and 17th centuries, the vast majority of Anglican parochial clergy and bishops would have understood their church as sitting very comfortably among the churches of the magisterial Reformation. Contrary to the continuity theme stressed by the earlier historiography, now woefully out of date, the late Patrick Collinson, among the most distinguished Reformation historians, concluded, quote, the English Reformation was the greatest of all disjunctions in the history of a nation which has lived by a virtuous myth of continuity. So Collinson saying, this is something we prize as the English, this continuity thing, but you know what? Actually, it's a bit of a myth. Calvinism, Collinson concludes, can be regarded as the theological cement of the church under King James I, for example. He talks about other periods too, but that's just one he's referring to there. Nor should one exclude here the greatest critic, at least prior to Archbishop William Laud, of certain forms of Puritanism, the judicious Hooker. More recent interpreters of Richard Hooker have dismantled the older interpretation that viewed him as the architect of the Anglican via media par excellence. Now, here, I don't mean to paint with too broad a brush. There's still debate and interesting, I think, very fruitful discussion and disagreement among scholars, among scholars of Hooker. But certainly there are those, Torrance Kirby, Nigel Atkinson, and others, who have portrayed Hooker as definitely writing within a broadly reformed theological setting, even though his position displays some idiosyncratic features, especially on essential matters, most notably justification, which, as we know, I hope we'll all be reminded of this, the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, justification which Luther called the linchpin that kept the church's gospel witness on track. Hooker's position on that is virtually indistinguishable from that of his reformed predecessors. Hooker's differences with the Puritan Walter Travers at the Temple were not trivial. I think there are some interesting things going on there. There are definitely differences of opinion, but here's the point. They're both swimming in the same reformed theological ocean. Now, what about after Elizabeth's reign? Well, into the 17th century, it's clear that most Anglicans did not consider Protestantism a dirty word, nor understand their teaching as opposed to that of the magisterial reformers on the continent, at least not on essential matters. Perhaps one of the best illustrations of this truth is the Anglican participation in the Synod of Dort. Yes, the Synod of Dort had Anglican participation. Not just participation, but they wrote some of the canons. Now, normally, we associate the Synod of Dort, 1618 to 1619, with Dutch Calvinism, and rightly so. But though it was called to address the challenge of Arminianism, the Council, as I said, is usually associated only with Dutch Calvinism, the famous 5 points of Calvinism. But the gathering actually included Reformed theologians and prelates from several European countries, including 5 participants from England. King James I sent over George Carleton, the Bishop of Llandaff, and John Davenant, among others. Nor were these Anglicans, as I said, mere observers. They helped to draft some of the agreed canons. Okay, well, some may object here that a Calvinist council would naturally attract some Calvinists, right? And there were some Calvinists in the Church of England. But what about their contemporaries? Obviously, not everyone agreed with the Bishop of Llandaff. What about the Caroline Divines? Now, most of the Caroline Divines were certainly not Calvinists. Nevertheless, most had few qualms about identifying themselves as Protestants. One historian has written that, quote, the Carolines considered themselves fully Protestants and budged not at all in their animosity to Rome. For example, John Cousin, whose collection of private devotions is often cited as the apogee of Catholic Anglicanism, worshipped with the non-episcopal Huguenot in Paris, and I like this touch, I don't recommend it, but it is amusing, disinherited his son for becoming a Roman Catholic. He was definitely a Protestant. Similarly, Archbishop John Bramhall accepted the legitimacy of Lutheran orders and the episcopal character of German Lutheran superintendents. Again, our older portrait of the Caroline Divines has been skewed. It is an error to read back into the 17th century positions taken by some later Anglicans, much later. All right, allow me to clarify at this point what I'm not saying. One cannot argue that the Church of England, constituted in the 16th and 17th centuries, was no different from the continental Reformed churches. Obviously, they were. Obviously, there wouldn't have been a Puritan movement emerging under Elizabeth I if there had been complete consensus on all issues. There were differences, and some of these differences were significant, differences within the Church of England, and also, of course, differences between Anglicans in England and Reformed folk on the continent. The preservation of the historic episcopate, the retention of more elaborate liturgical forms, and the whole preservation of something like the cathedral system in England has few parallels elsewhere in Protestant Europe, and that's notable. Nothing wrong with celebrating that. Though we should remember while we're doing that even that isn't as weird for continental Protestants as we sometimes now today assume. Again, it's a problem of reading today's situation back into the 17th century or 16th century. Right? Remember that even Calvin did not rule out episcopacy as an acceptable church polity in certain circumstances. And remember that 16th century continental Reformed Christians were far more liturgical than most of their descendants would later prove to be. Secondly, nor would I argue that all post-Reformation developments within Anglicanism are somehow illegitimate, or that positive growth over time should not be acknowledged. Indeed, the first generation of the Oxford movement did articulate valid concerns, especially regarding the unfortunate political character of the Church of England. Having the church be almost a kind of arm of the English bureaucracy was not a good thing. Nor am I saying that we should all return to the party battles of the past. What I am saying is that recovering a proper respect for and appreciation of the Protestant Reformation in general and of the English Reformation as it actually happened, and, you know, not as the sort of wishful thinking of some used to have been accustomed to kind of construe it, that sort of recovery of an understanding of the English Reformation is essential to a fuller and deeper appreciation of Anglican identity. I know some have responded to this argument of mine by saying, well, you're kind of taking a particular period and you're freezing that period and saying, oh, that's what we should, you know, that sums up Anglican identity. Problem with that is I'm not really taking a very tiny period. I'm taking the period from, what, 1558 to the latter part of the 19th century, 300 plus years. This is not an isolated position or situation. Also, and I'm going to address this in a second, it does raise some questions about the status of the Anglican formularies, and do they really have any kind of authoritative status at all? Why is it so difficult for some Anglicans to claim the word Protestant? It obviously wasn't for our founders back in the 1780s who adopted the title of the Protestant Episcopal Church. Remember, there was quite a concerted campaign in the late 19th century by Anglo-Catholics to get rid of the word Protestant, some Anglo-Catholics indulging in a ridiculous fantasy about calling it the American Church. This at a time when, you know, the other Protestant denominations greatly outnumbered, needless to say, the Roman Catholic Church greatly outnumbered the Episcopal Church. So the Protestant wasn't the dirty word for the founders of the American Church. A lack of knowledge or understanding of the Reformation, I think, is part of the answer here. The difficulty may arise from a common caricature. Perhaps when some of my high church friends hear the term Protestant today, they're inclined to think of the heirs of the Radical Reformation, Protestant sectarianism, Anabaptists. Or maybe they think about what comes to mind are 19th or early 20th century revivalism. You know, they think of Billy Sunday propping a chair up on a table and reciting the Lord's Prayer. Or they think of Elmer Gantry. And understandably, they recoil. Perhaps they think of American pop evangelicalism, the sort of seeker-sensitive evangelicalism of today, a Christianity that is often, sadly, disconnected from any tradition or historical consciousness and whose theology is several miles wide but about an inch deep. Or perhaps they think of Ian Paisley and anti-Catholic bigotry. If that's what one means by Protestant, then I too would balk from embracing that label. But it's important to remember that this sort of American Protestantism also bears a little resemblance to anything that Luther, Calvin, Cranmer, or even Knox, for that matter, ever envisaged. Ignoring or seriously misconstruing the Reformation has had, I think, some very unfortunate consequences. Surely a better way to understand Anglican identity and its peculiar genius would be to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest its foundational documents. All of them, not coincidentally, Reformation documents, products of the Reformation. And that's the best way to understand that what they're saying. I was in my graduate training in American intellectual history, We drew a lot from Quentin Skinner and this school, the Cambridge School, called Contextualists, where they said the best way to understand any kind of intellectual document from the past is to reconstruct its original context, right? So that, for example, someone might be using the word liberty a lot, but guess what? In 1590, what they meant by liberty is different from what we mean today by liberty. And so let's reconstruct that original context. Let's look at that original discourse, that original argument that people were having. And that's really important. If we ignore or distort the Reformation, we can't understand our formularies. That is, the Book of Common Prayer, especially in its definitive 1662 edition, the Articles of Religion, the 1662 Ordinal, or for that matter, and these are greatly overlooked and ignored, the first and second books of homilies. They're greatly overlooked and ignored in part because, by the way, there's a brand new edition of them out now with a edited by Gerald Bray that I highly recommend if you can get your hands on it. They're ignored frequently because folks don't like what they say. Now, of course, that's fine. You can disagree with them. These formularies are secondary authorities. They're not scripture. And you want to take issue with them, that's great. Make your case based on scripture. But first, let's be clear about what they're actually saying. The writings of later Anglican thinkers, including but not limited those of, say, Jewell, Hooker, or the Caroline Divines that I mentioned earlier, can certainly help us interpret that bedrock foundation. But where the later thinkers wander from the formularies, and this happened, of course, increasingly by the close of the 19th century, then I think they have less claim to be authentically Anglican, at least in the historic sense. Now, if you want to change that, okay, that's something you can do. But at least their claim to be authentically Anglican in an historical sense, in the original meaning of that word, brings that into question. This raises the whole question of whether or not Anglicanism is confessional. Yes, I'm going there. The 39 Articles were viewed as the Church of England's confessional standard by other Reformed churches at the time. You can read French Protestants, you can read Swiss Protestants who talk about it, talk about the 39 Articles all the time as, well, that's the confession of the Church of England. The stipulations regarding clerical subscription to the Articles confirm this interpretation. In 1604, clerical subscription was required under canon law. With the Restoration in 1660, clerical subscription was reimposed. Between 1689 and the mid-19th century, clergy swore the following oath: I, so-and-so, do willingly and from my heart subscribe to the 39 Articles of Religion of the United Church of England and Ireland, and to the three articles of the 36th canon, and to all things therein contained. Pretty straightforward. Now, the form prescribed was changed in 1865, was slightly weaker. It still required an explicit assent to the 39 Articles of Religion. A new form of words was introduced in 1975, unfortunately much weaker. I would argue, and here I know I'm out of sync with most of humanity, the Protestant Episcopal Church really erred in deciding not to require clerical subscription when it organized itself back in the 1780s. The motives were mixed, and some of it had to do with latitudinarianism. And actually, there were some old high churchmen who thought it was a good idea to require subscription. Prior to the destabilizing changes that came during the late 19th century, most Anglicans of either the evangelical or the old high church party, and even some broad churchmen, you know, broad churchmen by that day's standards, neither ignored the formularies nor sought to impose upon them far-fetched interpretations that flatly contradicted the views of their authors. This, of course, is precisely what John Henry Newman did in Tract 90. There's a reason that Tract 90 was controversial, so controversial that they had to shut down the whole operation. But what people forget is that Newman later came clean on this. Newman later acknowledged his error. After entering the Roman Catholic Church, he remarked that his fanciful attempt to remake Anglicanism into something at odds with its actual history was, in his words, quote, an impossible idea, and ultimately, quote, untenable. Why? He explained, because the entity that he had created, quote, was indeterminate in its provisions and without substantive existence in any age or country, closed quotes. In other words, I made up a church, right? I came up with this sort of idea. It was a cool idea, but it didn't have any historical reality. High churchmen today, I think, can legitimately celebrate the distinctive features of the Church of England. That's what the old high church folks did. They talked a lot about the liturgy. They talked a lot about the distinctives of the liturgy. My experience in Northwestern PA, when we first moved there 18 years ago, and we went to Presbyterian churches, I thought to myself, I'm a low churchman. I'm very evangelical. This whole Presbyterian worship thing is not going to be a big problem for me. Lasted about 3 weeks. And I concluded, I really miss the prayer book. I really miss Anglican worship. So nothing wrong with emphasizing that. But all Anglicans would do well not, as I said, to read back into the formative 16th and 17th centuries an easy synthesis that, in some respects, is really at odds with the historical reality. If we do so, Anglicanism becomes a kind of wax nose, you know, useful for those whose imaginations can form it into almost anything they fancy, but not really very historically accurate. Placing the work of English divines of both the 16th and 17th centuries within their original contexts, within the context of what some scholars term the Long Reformation, underlines their close relationship with non-English reformers, who, by the way, felt they were doing something very similar. Now, we may disagree with some of their conclusions and the direction that they take and moving away from episcopacy, for example. But they strived also to repair and renew the Church Catholic, not along Roman or papal lines, but based upon the same footing of Holy Scripture and the fathers and the councils of the early church. My hope and prayer is that at this time, the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, that this observance will promote such an essential reassessment of Anglicanism's Reformation roots. Thank you.
Thank you for a wonderful morning.
Sure, thank you.